Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine, analyze, and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Today's teens are navigating a world that's faster, louder, and even more connected than ever. Yet many feel more anxious, isolated, and overwhelmed. Suicide now ranks among the top three causes of death for adolescents, and symptoms of depression and anxiety often go unrecognized or dismissed as typical teenage mood swings. My guest today, Dr. Greg Hammer, physician, former Stanford professor, and best-selling author, believes that mindfulness can help young people cultivate balance and resilience in an uncertain world. His latest book, A Mindful Teen, Helping Today's Teenagers Thrive Through Gratitude, Acceptance, Intention, and Non-Judgment, offers parents, educators, and teens a framework for emotional wellness grounded in compassion and self-awareness. So this edition of 411 Teen will explore the state of teen mental health, the science behind mindfulness, and how small daily habits can nurture gratitude, acceptance, and calm even amid chaos. Dr. Hammer, welcome to 411 Teen.
Wonderful to be with you.
I know you've spent decades working with young folks. How do you see the mental health landscape in recent years? How do you see the shift that has occurred?
I think this is the most difficult time for kids and teenagers in my lifetime. And I'm old enough to be retired as a physician at Stanford, where I took care of mostly kids with congenital heart disease in the intensive care unit in the operating room. But many of them came back regularly, and I got to know them and interact with their families. And then, of course, I've had a couple myself. I've got an 18-year-old as a freshman in college now. I think there are factors that I certainly didn't encounter when I was a teenager, and I think are really new to this generation, sort of the post-COVID generation, if you will. And they include things like gun violence in schools, certainly nothing we encountered, the political divide where members of families are alienated from one another, and former friends and certainly family members are sometimes not even on speaking terms. Social media, we could talk about for hours, a double-edged sword. There are certainly good things about it. And especially during COVID, I think it helped connect teens to some degree. But then the excessive screen time and potential bullying, shaming, and various other negative elements of social media are certainly in the fore. Eco-anxiety, certainly nothing that we encountered. Will there be a habitable planet for my kids and my grandchildren? A very real issue now. So there are just so many factors that teens face. I think college admission is more competitive than ever as well. I saw my 18-year-old, many of her friends go to a very excellent and very competitive high school in Palo Alto, and many of them didn't get into anything other than perhaps a safety school, even though they had 4.0 GPAs and extracurricular activities. So this is also another stressor that teens face.
Yeah, I think we can get into that. Well, what are some of the warning signs that I would say parents and teachers often overlook because they seem to think that they're normal teenage behaviors? Some of the warning signs that, you know, the stress is taking a toll on them.
Sure. Well, you know, you mentioned, I believe, that many teens who commit suicide or who have suicidal ideation actually don't really have any obvious warning signs. They're doing well. They're bright kids, they're overachievers, and those are the kids that maybe feel the most pressure in a number of arenas. And they may not show signs of depression or any kind of mood or mental health changes. But for others, there certainly are potential signs that more isolated, spending more time in their room with the door closed, more screen time, maybe their performance in school and athletics is sort of tapering off, short-tempered, maybe don't want to listen at all. But of course, as you suggested, these are signs that many teens who will do just fine are exhibiting. So it's a vexing topic.
Yes, to say that that is certainly true. What impact do you think, and I think you've touched on a lot of them, we'll probably go over some of them a little more in depth, but what about this whole, what I call, and it's been called compare culture? How do you think that that has impacted the emotional development of teens? You know, there's so much competition and comparison today. It certainly was not nearly that much when I was in school.
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. One factor is social media, as we've touched on. Kids are seeing sort of idealized versions of their peers and adults on social media, and this leads to a lot of self-scrutiny and maybe low self-esteem, negative body image, etc. So social media is certainly one of the drivers of this sort of comparison issue that you mentioned. And yes, I just think that the competition in general, like for college admission, for example, sort of promotes comparison with one's peers. Teens are really, in a real sense, competing with each other. I know at the local high schools in Palo Alto High School and Gunn High School, many colleges and universities will not take more than a certain number of kids from these schools. And so if you're not in the top 10% academically and with respect to athletics and other extracurricular activities, then your chances of getting admitted to one of your top choices certainly are much diminished. So there is just intense competition, and that really causes teens to compare themselves to their peers. So I think there are a number of drivers.
It seems like that the traditional coping methods are not enough for today's generation. Do you see that? And why do you think that is the case?
That's a good point. I think, first of all, just kind of getting the 30,000 foot view, let's look at the way our brains are wired. We're really wired through evolutionary forces, I think, for survival and not for happiness. So I often mention that, 200,000 years ago, our forebears may have been sitting around a fire trying to keep their family warm in a cave. And it was a real possibility that there could be a predator like a saber-toothed tiger lurking outside the mouth of the cave. So it was adaptive and actually behooved the adults to be wary, to be rather negative, to think of the worst thing that might happen, to catastrophize, in other words, because this might have actually kept them alive longer. They may have had more offspring accordingly if they were wired that way. And so these genes and epigenetic factors that code for this sort of negativity and wariness propagated through the population. And here we are, 200,000 years later, we're kind of stuck with brains that are wired this way. Only now, this sort of stress response and negativity is not necessarily, or very often, in fact, triggered by actual physical threats, usually just triggered by our thoughts. And this is certainly maladaptive. And so this is the way all of us are wired. And, teens are no different. So they're wired to be rather negative and wary. And this affects the way they look at others, the world, and notably themselves. And this really applies to all of us, but I think that's sort of the background.
Well, as we look at how relationships change, what about the parental-child relationship? Parents today they're wanting to be their best friend. At least that's what I'm encountering. And don't know, don't seem to realize or recognize the role of the parent is not always to be the friend. Do you see that as a factor at all in their coping?
I do. I think it's, I hate to paint parents with a broad or too broad a brush, but I was certainly that way myself. I think it was a sort of a reaction to the way I was raised. At least my father certainly didn't present himself as a friend. He was a strict disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it may be in reaction to that. In fact, I did favor sort of a friendly relationship with my kids, even though I certainly was tough on them at times. But no, I think that's very common. If you look back at the generations, you can see, and certainly these are generalizations, but
of course, yeah.
My generation largely grew up with one working parent, typically the father.
Mm-hmm.
Things were not nearly, the parents were not nearly as involved, especially the fathers, in their kids' lives. I know that, for example, I don't remember ever having a conversation about college admission, and certainly didn't get help from my parents as far as that went, applying and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many parents are hovering, so-called helicopter parents, and they've got kind of their hands in all aspects of their kids' lives. And also, as you suggested, I think there is a directive to be more involved and more, on a friendly basis. And I think discipline has diminished in general. And, that may be good. It may not be good in some cases. But, I think you can see what generational changes have occurred over the last couple of generations. And I think the good news is that parents are typically much more involved, including fathers and mothers. But on the other hand, many families have both parents working,
mm-hmm.
And this has sort of changed the nature of parent-child relationships.
Yeah, it's changed the dynamics of the family also.
Absolutely.
I know when I was growing up, even though we were all going in our different directions and had different activities, after school, extracurricular activities, we usually got together at dinner, okay? And
yes.
parents don't have dinner together anymore. Families don't eat dinner together. Half the parents don't cook, you grab something very quickly. But hold your thoughts. We're going to take a brief break, and then I will get back to you, and we will continue to explore what's happening with today's teens. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I have the privilege of talking with Dr. Greg Hammer. He is sharing his insights on today's teens. He has a new book out called A Mindful Teen, Helping Today's Teenagers Thrive Through Gratitude, Acceptance, Intention, and Non-Judgment. Dr. Hammer, what inspired you to develop the GAINE framework?
That's an interesting story, I think. Around 2012, a group was convened at Stanford to address the problem of burnout among physicians. It was called WellMD, and I was part of that group. And we looked at the drivers and potential remedies of burnout. Burnout just being the physical and emotional exhaustion that many of us experience related to chronic stress. So I got very interested in chronic stress and stress physiology and what can be done about it. And the WellMD group came up with a rubric for evaluating drivers and potential remedies of burnout. It was very expensive when a physician left Stanford, cost maybe $1 million for recruitment and disruption in clinics and also in research labs. And so it was worth putting some resources into trying to figure out what the drivers of burnout are and whether we could do something about it. And the drivers included the culture in which we work, the efficiency of our practice. And then the third domain is personal resilience. And that was of particular interest to me. And so I started really doing a deep dive into resilience. I've been a longtime meditator and very interested in personal wellness and how we can come up with a remedy in our own lives for chronic stress. And so I took a deep dive there, and I wanted to come up with, you know, in medicine, first of all, we love algorithms. So gain is an algorithm. I figured if there are five domains to an algorithm, that's too many. I can't remember that many myself. And if it was three, we'd probably be leaving something important out. So I just thought, what are the real essential domains of stress reduction and happiness? And the four I came up with are gratitude, acceptance, intention, and non-judgment. And these are really the fundamentals of mindfulness, if you will. And so I derived a mindfulness-based practice embracing these gain elements. And I came up with meditation, which we begin the day with this gain practice, and it can be done in as little as 3 or 4 minutes. So I told my trainees, you know, set your alarm 3 minutes earlier before you go to bed. If you're going to get up at 5:30, then get up at 5:27 and go to bed 3 minutes earlier. In other words, many people think that meditation is something that requires sitting still for 30 minutes and not scratching an itch and maybe being in an uncomfortable position and not having any thoughts. And that's not true. There are many types of meditation, but for this mindfulness meditation practice, which is designed to address this burnout and chronic stress and increase our personal resilience, I just made it a very brief practice where, you know, we sit quietly and after we get up in the morning and open the blinds and do our morning hygiene, find a comfortable place to sit, close our eyes. We do a slow, deep, deliberate breathing practice and then a self-guided tour of that for which we're grateful, something uncomfortable or painful that we can't change and are best served by accepting, underscoring what our intentions are. And we need intention and purposefulness because, as I said, our brains are really wired for survival and not happiness. So if we want to be happier, we have to have a plan, just like we would keeping our body healthy, keeping our mental health optimal. We need a plan. And the end that we contemplate is non-judgment. So I provide some tools for learning how to be less judgmental. And then we return to slow, deep, deliberate breathing. So that just sort of took off. I was asked to give a lecture on the WellMD rubric and to a group of hospital administrators, and then another talk. Then I had a sabbatical and I decided to write a book called Gain Without Pain, the gain being in caps and the acronym. And then when I was on the verge of retiring, I just, you know, I had, it's actually my partner's daughter, who's now 18, but she was 11 at the time. And I just thought, you know, this is such a difficult time for teens, and it was sort of right there in front of us. And can we apply the GAIN method to families, coaches, teachers, counselors, so we can be more mindful for our teens and really present, excuse me, a model for having them cope with all of these stressors that have really cropped up in the last generation.
Would you take a few minutes for the listening audience and elaborate on each of the pillars, the gratitude, what is that for them, and acceptance and intention and non-judgment? And just how, I think first just defining them, because I think it's beneficial for them to understand exactly what it is, what you,
sure.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so gratitude, I think, is, and these four domains are really not anything of my own device, of course. These are, you know, embraced by, I think, most or almost all spiritual and philosophic traditions. Gratitude is so essential to happiness. And as an example, we may know somebody who's poor and happy, somebody who's physically challenged and happy, but you can't really even imagine somebody who's ungrateful and happy. And, you know, there are lots of people writing and practicing journaling and having gratitude practice, if you will. There are studies about the importance of gratitude. And it turns out that, I'll refer to one study in particular, which shows that though we tend to be a little whiny and negative, I think that's well demonstrated that we have a negativity bias.
Yes,
right?
We do.
And on the other hand, we have this amazing quality called neuroplasticity. So we have 85 or 100, a billion neurons in our brain, and each one communicates with as many as 1,000 other neurons. So we have as many as 85 to 100 trillion synapses, or these connections between neurons. And every time we have a thought, there's actually a little electrical pathway, if you will. And the more we have that thought, the more entrenched that pathway becomes. And so with regard to gratitude, if we have thoughts of gratitude, we become more grateful over time. And there was a study at Duke University called Three Good Things. And just to make a long story about the study short, basically they had people take a quality of life survey before entering the study, which was a validated study, basically a happiness study, if you will. And then the practice that they pledged to participate in was simply thinking of and ideally writing down, if you're a journaler, three things that went well during the day. So it's really a gratitude practice, if you will. And it really doesn't take much time or any time. I tend not to be a journaler, but I got into the practice of thinking about three good things that went well when I'm just turning down the bed linen. So really, it doesn't take any time at all. And it's easy to come up with three good things, right?
Yeah.
You know, I had a nice walk with my dogs, had a cup of coffee with a friend. There's so many things that if we think about it, went well each day, and things for which we can be grateful. And what the investigators found out is that 6 weeks of this daily practice resulted in improved sleep and improved quality of life. So in other words, greater happiness. So that's gratitude. I think we can all agree that gratitude is really an essential part of having a positive outlook and being happier. Acceptance is important because we can't just pretend that everything is okay. I lost my son at the age of 29. We've all lost loved ones, many during COVID, for example, and people have passed alone in a hospital bed. But we've all had pain. It's intrinsically part of life as much as joy is part of life. So it behooves us to, as the Serenity Prayer would have it, Liz, to distinguish between what we can change and what we can't change. And if there's something that is uncomfortable or painful to us that we cannot change, we're really well served by learning to accept that. So when we're doing our gain meditation and we're doing this slow, deep, deliberate breathing with our eyes closed, we contemplate that for which we're grateful. We get to acceptance. We actually identify a painful thought or experience and imagine, as we breathe slowly and deeply, bringing this into our heart. So I'm actually physically imagining our chest opening, our heart opening, and bringing this pain into our heart and sitting with it and nurturing it, embracing it, and relaxing our muscles into it, breathing into it. And eventually, I think we can ask ourselves the question, can I live with this pain forever? And the answer will be yes. And then we transition, as we continue to do our slow, deep, deliberate breathing, to intention. And why intention? It's, you know, I love Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition of mindfulness. It's really fully experiencing the present moment on purpose, non-judgmentally. Why on purpose? Because, as I said, and I think you would agree, that our brains are wired to be negative.
Yep.
Right. And also our minds and our brains are wired to be very distracted. So it's very hard for us to fully experience the present moment. If we close our eyes and just try to focus on our present physical experience, the chair, the pressure of the chair against our body, the sound of a passing automobile or airplane, our mind will quickly begin to go to the future, you know, the list of things we have to do later, or things we may be embarrassed about that happened yesterday. It's very hard for us to reside in the present moment mentally, and that's where happiness is, right? Yep. If we think about our happiness, our happiest moments, they involve being fully present. You know, we're walking through the forest, we're appreciating our footfall against the soft pine needles of the forest floor and breathing that wonderful air and oxygen-enriched environment and noticing the light filtering through the treetops, the canopy above. We are fully present. This for me is, you know, communing with nature is a great example. I'm not worried about tomorrow or yesterday. I'm right there and I just feel, you know, I could pass away right now and I'd be perfectly okay with that. You know, we're just, it's an experience. So we have to, if we want to really learn how to be more present, we have to have a plan. It's just like, as I said, keeping our body physically well, going to the gym, going for walks, playing tennis or pickleball, whatever is your thing. But we have to be intentional about it if we want to maximize our physical wellness, and the same with our mental wellness and our ability to be present. So during the game practice, we actually focus on the present moment, our current experience. And it might be for 5 seconds today and this week and maybe 10 seconds next week or next month. And we learn, you know, again, it's this neuroplasticity that we can really take advantage of. And then, you know, we transition to the N in GAIN, which is non-judgment. And I think the important principle here is that some judgment is important. Discernment rather than judgment is important, but we are overly judgmental. Right. And when you combine this with our negativity bias, the way we judge others, the world, and most notably ourselves is often very negative. And teens are especially prone to this, you know, for all the reasons we discussed. Mm-hmm. So I offer some imagery as we do our slow, deep, deliberate breathing. Let's visualize an image of the Earth apparently floating in space, one of these beautiful NASA images. And the Earth is a lovely planet, but it is really doesn't possess the qualities of goodness or badness. It just is the planet that it is. And it's only logical then for me to understand that since I am of the Earth, I'm just a human being. I'm neither good nor bad. I just am the person that I am. And we're thinking this and reinforcing these thoughts as we do our slow, deep, deliberate breathing. I simply am the person I am, neither good nor bad. I simply am. Maybe then we transition to I am. Mm-hmm. Just sit with this I amness for 15 seconds. And then we return our focus purely to the slow, deep, deliberate breath. And that's the practice. And I think that's some insight into why I think those four domains are really the essence of happiness.
What I hear you saying is that mindfulness literally rewires the brain toward
absolutely
greater calm and focus. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Oh, I think that is absolutely the case. And, you know, it's just like the three good things practice. When you think of three things that went well, three things for which you're grateful at the end of the day and in the evening before going to bed, it's what you're doing. And you do this repeatedly. I think we learn, you know, as an educator, I think I can say with confidence, the way we learn is in small steps, small bites, baby steps, and repetition. And so this is an example. It's can be a short practice. Certainly the three good things practice doesn't take much time at all. But by repetition, doing it every evening, you just can imagine the sort of electrical firing of these connected neurons and these pathways that are becoming more and more entrenched. And this becomes, to a greater extent, the way we think and the way we are. And it's rather miraculous. And I think it happens almost immediately. So, you know, I've had people say, well, I did my GAIN meditation just for one or two mornings. And it was, you know, maybe I'm driving to work and somebody cuts me off and I start to make all these negative judgments, for example, and then a light bulb goes off. Hey, I just did my GAIN meditation. I recognize that I, and in fact, we are neither good nor bad. And
right.
Drop that judgment, get a little dopamine hit instead of an adrenaline hit. Yeah. And I think this is something that you begin to experience rather immediately. And I find that really miraculous. I think the human brain is such a fascinating entity, if you will.
How does mindfulness differ from relaxation or self-care?
I think it's really a component of self-care.
Okay.
And, you know, it is a way to relax. You know, in other words, we're not really wired to be relaxed necessarily, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our minds are
No.
very hyperkinetic and they're all over the place. And so if you want to relax, you have to have a vehicle, you have to have a practice, if you will. And that's where the intention comes in. So I think it is, you know, a mindfulness practice is a way to relax. So it's sort of the umbrella under the umbrella of relaxation, but it's more than just relaxation. It's actually retraining the mind to be more positive and more present. So it's absolutely an essential part of self-care. And, you know, we could talk in detail about self-care with respect to our physical well-being, but also our mental well-being. And that's really what we're discussing.
Right. How does mindfulness, and we may not be able to answer this, but let me just pose it to you at least. How does mindfulness coexist with therapy or medication?
That's a great question.
Okay. That's what I was wondering.
I think that's a good question.
Well, before you get started, because I don't want to have to interrupt you, we're going to take a brief break and then we can get started and I won't have to interrupt you at all. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and this edition of 411 Teen is talking with Dr. Greg Hammer. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I am talking with Dr. Greg Hammer, physician, mindfulness expert, and author of A Mindful Teen, helping today's teenagers thrive through gratitude, acceptance, intention, and non-judgment. Dr. Hammer, you may continue. I was just talking about mindfulness, asking you about mindfulness coexisting with therapy and medication.
Yes, absolutely. So, Liz, I've done a number of interviews related to something called the winter blues. So it'll be clear why I'm bringing that up in a moment, but many people conflate the winter blues, which is a kind of sadness that we experience, and it's topical now because we just, for most of the country, ended daylight savings time, and we're on to standard time, and it's getting dark earlier, and that will continue until we have the equinox around December 21st. So many of us get sad at this time, and just, you know, our mood is down a little bit, and so what are the remedies for this? There are a number of them, but I think mindfulness is one thing that can really help us. But on the other hand, there's something called seasonal affective disorder, which is a form of depression. And in that case, I think people are well served getting help from a qualified psychologist or psychiatrist. So, you know, with regard to milder mood changes, I think mindfulness can be just such a wonderful tool, but there still is a role for psychotherapy and even in some cases medication when, you know, people have depression, for example, or lots of anxiety that's refractory to mindfulness practice, etc., and even therapy, so talk therapy. So I think there's a, you know, it's a spectrum, right? It's you know, on one end of the spectrum people are happy, and then, you know, maybe in the middle, we all have periods of sadness, let's say, and then moving along that spectrum, sometimes there's real deep depression and anxiety. These are very common. And in that case, therapy from a qualified therapist and sometimes medication are really helpful. So I think we have to avoid identifying mindfulness or other, ways to relax and so on as being a be all end all. I think it's a great tool. It's been extremely helpful for me and many others, but it doesn't necessarily solve every problem.
Right. What role can schools play in building mindful communities for students?
I think that adults in general, first of all, our kids are watching us, right? We can't just instruct them verbally and expect them to listen to us and do everything we suggest that they do. They're watching us and they're watching what we do as much or more than what we say. And so it behooves us as parents and teachers and counselors and coaches to embrace mindfulness, because if we exhibit gratitude, for example. So this is something, a teacher, a high school teacher can work into their daily approach to teaching, let's all be grateful for all these good things that we have. And certainly as parents, if we do sit down at the dinner table, or maybe we have the opportunity to be driving our teenager before they get their driver's license and drive themselves, we have one-on-one time. We can take advantage of that and talk about gratitude, but also we have to embody it. Otherwise, it doesn't really make the impression on them that is most effective. And the same thing goes with acceptance. So, by having conversations with and exhibiting these qualities of gratitude, acceptance, intention, and non-judgment, for example, I think we can have great influence on our teens, even if they don't seem to be, listening to us. I think, for example, it's remarkable how kids can remember something, just a small act of kindness or a show of gratitude or these other domains on the part of their parent. For example, I still remember my father was rather gruff and a tough guy, and I don't remember him apologizing for anything except for once. And it was a small thing, but it made a big impression on me. It sort of was a little bit of a window into his persona. Here's this guy who was a Marine, he's a tough guy, he's very, heavy on discipline and education. And yet here I see another side of him. And so it's his actions and things he said to me, but only because he embodied them. It's the small things that we don't necessarily think our kids are paying attention to that we may embody and display to them that really can make a big difference in their lives. And so I think it's important for all of us as adults to embody these elements. And I think our kids are paying attention more than we think sometimes.
Do you have any suggestions as to how parents might introduce mindfulness without it feeling like a task or a lecture?
You mentioned that we don't often have dinner. Many families don't have dinners together. And that's has certainly been true in my case, especially with my 18-year-old. They have extracurricular activities that run into the evening and then homework and so on. But we always made an effort to have dinner together. And this was the case with my kids too. I was often working myself past the dinner hour, but there are opportunities for us to have meaningful conversations with our kids, whether it's while we're driving them somewhere or having a meal together, or just maybe we knock on their door and go into their room in the evening before bed. And, we can work these elements into the way we interact with our kids. We can show gratitude, express gratitude for each other. You're such a great kid. I'm so grateful to have you as my son or daughter. Or bring up a difficult topic. I know that many topics are difficult for kids to hear and for parents to discuss. Things like, sexual activity, sexually transmitted diseases, bullying. If you notice a change in your kid's behavior, just spend a few minutes one-on-one and try to drill down on that. And I think in the process, you can bring in these elements, acceptance, for example. Well, it looks like you're having a tough time in this area of school. Is there something that can be done about it? And maybe it's just something that you have to accept. Like a child may have acne, for example, and maybe it's just not something that can be well treated. And so, how do we learn to accept our physical imperfections, for example? Or how do we learn to accept that a friend sort of cut them out of their life, or a breakup with a significant other in high school, things that can be really painful? How do we learn to accept that pain? This is a place where I think parents can really have an influence on their kids just by having those one-on-one conversations and also embracing and exhibiting those qualities. I think that's equally important.
Well, you have suggestions as to how parents can protect their own mental health while supporting their children at the same time.
I think, Liz, that we have to really focus on our physical well-being because it's so inexorably linked to our mental health. And also, of course, focus on our mental health. And I think this is where a mindfulness practice can be so important. But also, we have to focus on our physical well-being. And I think a lot of people underestimate the importance of sleep, for example. And certainly our teens, sleep is so essential and a minority of them get enough sleep, unfortunately. But we ourselves, in order to maintain our own well-being, need to really focus on our sleep hygiene. We almost all of us need 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And there's a whole litany of things we can do that are considered sleep hygiene. Similarly, I think exercise is so critical to our physical well-being and our mental well-being. So we could talk for hours on what types of exercise, how to do it, and so on. But start with something. Just get up and go for a brisk walk around the block if you're working at home, periodically, every hour and a half or so. And then nutrition is so important. And again, this is a way
You're
that we
reading
can
my
really.
mind. I'm just sitting here shaking my head going, yep, because nutrition,
Well, those
exercise,
are the
sleep.
three domains of our physical well-being: sleep, exercise, and nutrition. And again, this is something that we can do for ourselves, move toward a more plant-based diet, really be mindful about what we're eating. And, of course, that's a whole separate topic unto itself. But this is a way also, like with mindfulness, that we can influence our kids. How are we eating? They're watching what we're eating. We can't tell them not to eat junk food if we're eating junk food. And, we can't tell them not to eat junk food when we go to the grocery store and we fill up our cart with highly processed and junk foods. And that's what we have in the house. So this is rather obvious, but this is how we influence our kids, our teens. It's by the habits that we embody, both physically and mentally.
When we talk about our teens, what does hope look like for the teen who is struggling with anxiety and depression right now?
These are such common mental health issues, not only for teens, but of course, adults. And I think it comes from, in large part, our negativity bias and also our distraction with the past and the future and inability to be present. So, really, what is depression? It's a combination of focus on the past when we have, negativity
Negative.
about things we've done, said, about our own self-image, and also distraction with the future. We overthink the future, and combined with our negativity bias, we generate a lot of fear and anxiety. And so depression and anxiety are really the two most common mental health issues that adults and teens face. And I think we need a plan, and there is hope. I think that, first of all, we talked about all these factors that are stressors for teens, and those things will evolve as they become adults. And so, no matter how difficult things seem now, there's always hope that if we have intention and these other elements, gratitude, acceptance, and non-judgment, the future is always can be brighter. And I think it's a combination of teens evolving into adults, having that prefrontal cortex fully developed, and also kind of acquiring life skills that are so critical. And that's really what we've been discussing.
Well, we have been discussing it, and I have not put a plug in for your book except to say that it exists. But I am talking with Dr. Greg Hammer. He has a new book out. He is the author of A Mindful Teen, Helping Today's Teenagers Thrive Through Gratitude, Acceptance, Intention, and Non-Judgment. Dr. Hammer, where can one access your book? Where can they get it?
Thank you, Liz. Well, they can go to the website for the book, which is simply amindfulteen.com. That's all lowercase, no punctuation. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and elsewhere. My personal website is greghammermd.com, and I think there's a link to the book there.
Okay.
So it's pretty easy to find.
Okay. All right. Well, I just want, you know, we're talking and talking and talking, and but goodness, I need to talk about, you know, some folks are listening to this. They really might want to buy the book. I thought it was very well done. I enjoyed reading it. In fact, I thought it was excellent. I really did. Kudos to you. It was very well done, and I think it'd be a good read for anybody that deals with teens. I have a couple questions before we close. Do you have suggestions on how we help teens manage perfectionism, fear of failure, and this whole self-criticism?
I'm going to just go back to these elements, the gain elements.
Okay.
You know, I think that one, we've talked about our negativity bias, and that's certainly something that teens exhibit. And the good news is, as I've said, we have this amazing quality called neuroplasticity. So I think through the way we interact with our teens, we can really influence them. But we have to start with our own well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that is really the, I hate to be repetitive, but I think that's the approach that I embrace and I would recommend to everybody.
If a parent or a teacher wants to start today, what's the first small mindful step that they could take that you might suggest to them? They want to start this. Where would
sure.
they start?
Well, I think the essential ingredients are, you know, for mindfulness, an element of mindfulness is mindfulness meditation. The breath is so important. You know, when we're stressed, our chest muscles and our diaphragm are somewhat tight, we can go a whole day without taking a deep breath. And
mm-hmm.
when we take a
yes.
slow, deep, deliberate breath, for example, as I write about, in through the nose to a count of three, filling the chest and abdomen, pausing to a count of three, and then slowly exhaling through the nose or mouth to a count of four, we open up the little air sacs in our lungs, we get more oxygen into our body, and importantly, we activate the parasympathetic nervous system. That's the side of the sort of unconscious or autonomic nervous system that keeps the sympathetic or fight or flight side of the nervous system in check. So when we take a slow, deep, deliberate breath, we actually activate the vagus nerve, and this tends to lower our heart rate and blood pressure and impart a sense of calm. So first, let's recognize the importance of something so simple as the way we breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an essential ingredient in mindfulness meditation or any other kind of meditation. And then again, just these four domains, I think we can start baby steps. The gain meditation is a 3-minute meditation practice. We may end up wanting to sit with it and enjoy it for a longer period of time as we go forward, but we can start even just with the breath and gratitude, like the three good things practice.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very simple way to get started with beginning to rewire your brain. And I think the more you do it, the more you enjoy it, the more you see the benefits, the more you want to sort of take a deeper dive into mindfulness. It's really, you know, can really change the way we think.
Any closing words of wisdom you want to share?
I'd like to say, Liz, that for anybody who's listening, we are all wired pretty much the same way. So we're all wired for this negativity bias. We tend to remember the negative and forget about the positive. And this often leads to sadness and even depression. And my message to everybody is really that we're all wired this way. This is not your dirty little secret. So don't be negatively self-judgmental because you have all these doubts and negativity. This is the way our brains are wired. Okay. And the good news is that we can actually do something about it. We can change the way we think.
Well, it's time out for 411 Teen. My guest has been Dr. Greg Hammer, physician, mindfulness expert, and author of A Mindful Teen, helping today's teenagers thrive through gratitude. Much appreciation to my listening audience for the privilege of your time and ear. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.